Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. President Biden's priority is fighting the coronavirus pandemic, including enforcing wearing of masks and greater physical distancing, boosting vaccine production to get 100 million vaccinated in 100 days. He also wants to make greater use of the Defense Production Act that the Trump administration also relied on as part of their Operation Warp Speed pandemic effort. I should also add that Biden on Monday signed a Buy American executive order beefing up government efforts to buy American-made products. That also is an endorsement of the Jones Act that limits maritime trade among U.S. ports to U.S.-made and owned ships, legislation that dates back to the 1930s to support the domestic shipbuilding industry that for some is criticized as being nonsensical, I should say, for opponents of the act. Others say that there would not be a domestic shipbuilding industry if it wasn't for that. Joining us today are three men who have led the Pentagon's Industrial Policy Office that oversees the DPA, and they are also all First Order Defense Industrial Strategists. Steve Grundman, who led the office in the Clinton administration, who's now with the Atlantic Council and the Grundman Advisory Consultancy. Brett Lambert, who led the office at the start of the Obama administration and is now a managing director at the Dinsmore Group Consultancy. And Dr. Jerry McGinn, who served in both the Obama and the Trump administration, teaches defense procurement at George Mason University. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. You guys all, at one point or another, have overseen the Defense Production Act to furnish the nation with critical capabilities. How should the Biden administration be using it? What can be accomplished if it's used correctly? And what did the Trump administration do either right or wrong, either that's worth keeping or worth scrapping? Jerry, why don't you start us off, because you actually served a little bit into this administration, or I should say the last administration.
Yeah, so the DPA is a Korean War law signed in 1951 that, you know, during a lot of my time in the Pentagon, it was sort of a sleepy kind of act. It's a very powerful authority that was used in a number of ways, but it really, really got a lot of attention in COVID because it was built to respond to events, national emergencies and crises like this. And so there's been a very strong use of it in the past year. There are three active titles: Title One, Title Three, and Title Seven. There's been it's been used in several different ways, and to some degree, to some effectiveness. But there's ways that can be done better. So the first in Title One, there's an allocation and distribution authority in DPA. So the distribution authority essentially allows you to rate contracts. This is something that's been done for decades, and it did play a role in the COVID response by allowing by rating orders so that the government orders get filled first. The second part of it is the allocation authority, which essentially allows you to take over a means of production or an area, industry by the government. And the Trump administration selectively used that, but really just used it to essentially direct companies to do something. So sort of a negotiating tactic, which is not really what the authority was created for. So, and the Biden administration has talked about using that to direct production in certain ways of PPEs and the like. Title III is the big investment function for DPA, and that's where $1 billion were appropriated in the CARES Act for that. And Defense Department, working with HHS, did launch a number of Title III projects focusing on COVID response and pharmaceutical development, but also use that money in ways that were a bit more controversial for defense industrial base needs. So that program is starting to really move well, and they've even established a loan authority, which is something that hasn't been used before. I think that there's been one loan done under that I think is done well, but there's definitely a good opportunity to relook at that and how it's structured for the new administration. And then finally, the Title VII, which is done, there's an authority under there that allows you to set up voluntary agreements that is sort of pre-positioning industry and government to address certain contingencies. And there was one signed by FEMA this year, or last year, excuse me, for a pandemic response. So I think that's another important thing that needs to be kind of fleshed out and tested in the Biden administration.
I should say, right, that you straddled the two administrations and spent many years in the Obama administration. So you're kind of a bipartisan observer on this, ultimately, as a civil servant. Brett, let me get your sense on this, right? Because one of the criticisms of the last administration was a sense of disorganization. I mean, folks at the Pentagon would say, look, we can only move as fast as the White House with a president who doesn't believe that this is really a big deal can move, right? At the end of the day, what do you think was right, wrong? More importantly, how does the Biden team need to use this authority to drive the kind of outcomes we want? Because it's not abundantly clear that we've harnessed as much as we need to harness in order to solve a challenge that's already killed more Americans than died in combat, certainly in the most recent wars, right? If you discount the Civil War.
Well, I think the previous administration used the DPA more as an instrument of mob threat than an effective tool of the execution of policy. And as you stated, the policy was lacking. So the threat of implementing DPA or the authority to implement DPA was used to cajole industry. That is not the most effective way to use DPA. As Jerry rightly pointed out, it has broad authorities, but it has to be guided by policy and it has to be guided by a well thought through policy that has end state in mind instead of really tactical. We need this in 2 weeks. The DPA is not going to be able to give you some kind of product in a short time frame. It needs to be thoughtful and careful. And I think where the previous administration failed is that they viewed DPA as almost an authoritarian tool and an instrument of power in absence of policy.
Don't hold back, Brett. Don't hold back. You know, it's always problematic when you keep this stuff bottled up. Steve, what's your sense as an industrial strategist? I was going to say, somebody who practices industrial strategery, right? But what's your sense on where we are and where we need to go, most importantly?
Well, let me just pick up from what Brett was saying. My particular criticism of the last administration's use of it was the poor communications around the Defense Production Act, allowing not least the specter of socialism to pervade discussions of the Defense Production Act, which it's anything but, on the one hand. But at the same time, communicating not least to businesses what was possible here and what the utilities and purposes of the law truly are in the manner that Jerry just explained to us. That would have been, I think, very, very helpful, because we don't know what capabilities, we don't always know, particularly in an emergency, what capabilities are out there in industry that could use a loan to expand production that would address a need, to take an example. Some communications of not only both what the DPA is, but also the administration's preparedness and willingness to use it, I think can go a long way toward accelerating the uses of it in an emergency, because then the grassroots can talk back to the government sensibly, and you don't have to go discover everything, which takes a long time.
You know, the DPA is a very effective nail, but it can't use an elephant to drive it in. You have to have a policy and a clear outcome in mind for the purpose. You just can't declare you're using it and then send everyone a flutter about, well, what does that mean? And I think that's where the last administration failed mightily. They had the big elephant. They had the big crisis. And they saw DPA as a nail, but they never approached it with a hammer. They just failed to understand how to effectively utilize and implement DPA, with some, as Jerry points out, some very good exceptions. But critically, a lot more could have been done with this very powerful tool.
And Vago, looking ahead, I hadn't taken up the second half of your question. I mean, looking ahead to the Biden administration's uses of it, we're still in the midst of a pandemic, maybe at the moment in the very worst of it. So, if assessments of, for example, the availability of PPE to get us all the way through probably the end of the summer have not been done, that needs to be done with a view toward perhaps invoking uses of particularly Title I in order to, you know, keep the crisis, the pandemic's need for these materiel up at the front of the order books of companies that can respond to them. And then beyond that, right, there's an issue of stockpiling. This will not, unfortunately, be the last pandemic we have to face, or for that matter, the last medical or health security crisis in the country. And so there's conceivably, it may not be as necessary to invoke the DPA in order to fill stockpiles, but let's at least have a plan for filling them. And as needed, maybe with Title III investments, create some capacity that enables industry to fill the stockpiles of these materials, which we're going to need the next time.
U.S. industry is willing to step up. There's been no pushback from U.S. industry. What you find from industry is that the uncertainty that's created by a federal policy where you're competing with 50 states. I mean, I frankly think the 50 governors should have gotten together and started talking about forming a country. In a pandemic like this, this is a federal response. It's exactly what DPA is designed to respond to. Absent that, the states are going to go out on their own. And that causes more disruption in industry because you're in essence now competing with richer states that can afford product made in the U.S. And that was just a failure of policy.
Jerry, let me bring you in on this, right? Because Brett makes an excellent point. And the biggest criticism of the administration was there was very little that was coordinated. It was a free for all. And the United States undermined some of its relationships around the world, in part by outcompeting some of its allies and partners, right? So, and the frustrating part of this is, having spoken to some very senior folks in the department, in January, it was known the magnitude of the problem. In January, it was known that we would not have enough PPE in order to do this. Congress has changed legislation to elevate the importance of industrial policy at the Pentagon. And indeed, there's a sense with Build Back Better, it's a top priority for the Biden team as well. A little bit like Peter Navarro, just very, very different in terms of how it's likely to be implemented, but in some ways similar. To start us off, Jerry, what does the change in legislation mean? Especially given that when you were doing the job, you were advising a unitary acquisition technology and logistics boss. You lived in the transition where now you were advising an A&S boss, right? An acquisition and sustainment and an R&E boss. So talk to us about what the change in legislation means at the department, and then the kind of strategy the new administration needs more broadly on industrial policy. Because at the end of the day, the notion that this is somehow a free market is just an absurdity. It's a monopsony. There is a customer that determines the outlook for the market. You know what I mean? It's not like there's a big fighter market out there. The department sets the conditions. The government sets the conditions on this.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I think the biggest thing that this change of legislation does is it gives a stronger platform for industrial-based matters inside the department. I don't see the split of acquisition technology and logistics in the two organizations has been that problematic, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is that the industrial policy role, giving it more authority, giving it that Seneca firm level, what it does is it gives it more leverage inside the department, because many of the industrial based matters the challenges are well known. I mean, these are the microelectronics, rare earth challenges, PPE was a little less known because that wasn't a Defense Department matter. But these things were known knowns that have been, well, I've written about in previous industrial capabilities reports, the White House report on industrial base matters back in 2017, 2018. But you know, it still took over 2 years for rare earth elements competitions to go from start to finish. In terms of the setting the requirements, getting the presidential determination, which is unsatisfactory. And so the fact that it took that long, and a lot of that is because there's other competing interests. You know, the military departments, yes, they recognize they need rare earths or they need new forging capabilities, but they're not going to choose that over another thing in their budget. So having that an ASD level is going to help a lot internal to the building, as well as getting more sway on Capitol Hill.
What do you think their approach needs to be?
Oh yeah, so going forward, I think they've got to pick their battles. I think the fundamental challenge that I'm going to see for the Biden administration is balancing reshoring versus Buy America. So the Buy America approach, I think, is problematic when it comes to industrial base, because it becomes a food fight. Whereas we need to focus really on getting out of the China business. Where do we have weaknesses in adversarial relationships with companies that are based in adversarial countries, and get out of that? Secondly, we've got to pick our priorities. You know, the last administration picked shipbuilding and microelectronics. This administration is going to pick, probably different. They're going to pick microelectronics as something else, but they can't do everything in the budgetary environment. The third point is we've got to use all of our tools. The DPA we talked about is incredibly powerful, incredibly good tool for industrial-based matters. But there's several other big programs, such as the one that Brett started, the Industrial Basis Analysis and Sustainment Program, manufacturing technology, the National Defense Stockpiles that Steve mentioned. These programs didn't have any attention prior to the pandemic. They were really chronically underfunded, did not have the attention they needed. And they still, that can go back to, the previous status quo if we don't have an ASD level kind of position. So I think that's important. And then the final point is that I think we need to, the Biden administration needs to focus on doing this with a little help from our friends. There are some areas where natural relationships on geographic, Canada, Mexico, or, capability that is Australia and mining, Japan and rare earth magnets, that we have natural partnerships that we need to strengthen. And this needs to be like, concretized. I mean, they've stood up this national technology industrial base several years ago, but it's just really a talking point. How do we get that into contracts? How do we get DPA, a Title III ability for companies based outside the United States and Canada, which is already in there, to compete for that? So that's be my kind of four-part plan on how I propose the Biden administration should follow.
Brent?
Well, all of you have heard my, stump speech I started giving in 2009 about the defense industry was becoming more global, more commercially, and more financially complex. The global is a supply chain, and I think we lost the bubble on microelectronics, certainly. We're losing the bubble on biology. Commercial, clearly, they've tried to address it through contracting vehicles like OTA, and I think they've done a fairly good job of reaching out to the commercial industry, but understanding where that industry comes from. And then the financially complex goes to the other title of DPA, which is CFIUS. Who has interest in companies that are providing U.S. Industry with capability and components, and what access do they have to them? We've all seen, or we're seeing, the effects of solar winds on software. The issue is large for industrial base, particularly as it becomes more global, more commercially and financially complex. And I'm not sure just putting a person under acquisition that reports up through USD of acquisition will be able to manage or have the heft to influence programmatic decisions, where we will have to then rely upon instruments like DPA to make up for shortfalls that we could have seen coming around the corner.
Do you, Steve, what's your sense? And I've got a follow-up question I want to hit you guys with. Steve?
I don't know if it's really taking issue with what Jerry said about the significance of the elevation of this job internally, but at least the first thing that strikes me is the utility of it outside the building. As a former deputy undersecretary of defense, I can tell you it's hard to carry the Pentagon's banner on an interagency or at the White House deliberation over something of great consequence. Harder, certainly, as a deputy, whatever, than it is as an assistant secretary. An assistant secretary, both the stature that that gives the job within the executive branch, but also with Congress, I think makes a difference, will make a difference to the appropriate prominence and hopefully efficacy of industrial policy, and industrial policies in this next administration.
To that point, right, Jerry, you want to get your sense on it and then quickly go across the line. I mean, ultimately, the Obama administration tried. The Trump administration may have been somewhat more successful in at least trying to make some form of unitary government-wide vision on industrial policy and strategy, right? We can debate whether it was right or wrong, but there was certainly an effort to try to achieve that aim. Start us off on what the executive agreement the president signed means and whether it's anything new from the Build Back Better Buy American stuff that's on has been on the administration's website as well as the Biden campaign's website.
Yeah, Vago, I think it generally reinforces what was already on the Build Back Better plan. And frankly, it's very similar to the Trump administration's Buy American, Hire American executive order, essentially calling for this the better enforcement of Buy America provisions, closing of loopholes. And this is focused on commercial industry, not defense. So it doesn't seem that much, different, and it doesn't changing laws by nature because it's executive order, but it reinforces the Biden mission. The concern I have is that this can then lend support to efforts on Capitol Hill for a Buy American provision that was in the House NDA last year, but did not make it to the final act, which is not productive for the defense industry, which is already one of the strongest domestic manufacturing sectors that we have.
And let me just ask you to advance that a little bit, right? Talk a little bit about the legislation, because Team Biden is saying, look, this should apply and primarily is about PPE, right? Personal protective equipment, vaccines, pandemic-related equipment. But there is that concern that we internationalized our defense industry, getting more for each dollar we spend by bringing our allies and partners into these programs, and that we could backslide on that, right? Go back to where we were in the 1990s.
Yeah, that is the challenge. And like I said, this gives wind to the backs of those that would push those kind of legislative priorities on the Hill. And that's, orthogonal with what the Biden administration message is about stronger relationships with partners and allies. So that's going to be a delicate balance for the new team they're going to have to walk going forward.
How does this need to connect to the department in a more meaningful fashion?
So traditionally, the Department of Defense and U.S. government in general has stayed away from the industrial policy as a as an objective. Given the free market system and the fact we don't do 5-year plans, essentially,
We do. It's called the FYDP. Yeah, and the DPP is a 15-year plan. Right. I mean, we do it. We just want to say we sort of don't. But every procurement decision is an existential decision for industry, and we keep making and buying crap we don't need because.
Yeah, no, understood it. I was going to mention the FYDP, but the general philosophy is that we have not felt that it was appropriate for the government to choose industrial policy, because what it does is then it becomes political football more than it needs to be. So, but what's happened during the Obama and over the Trump administration as well is that essentially the need for industrial policy became undeniable. And because of areas where we had gotten upside down in adversarial relationships, you know, and the ones that we've talked about previously. And so there is a need for that. And I think you're definitely seeing moves in that direction. I think it's, I would argue that you'd want to keep this focused principally on national security imperatives when you talk about defense industrial policy. I would not want to mix it with the White House objectives for domestic political, for jobs and the like, because then it becomes, then it's not really addressing the national security needs, but it's addressing domestic political needs, which I would think is inappropriate. I mean, there needs to be communication, of course, but on these things, but I would want to keep it as somewhat at an arm's length from some of the your domestic work objectives.
Well, one of the rare times I disagree with Jerry, national security is domestic security, and domestic security is domestic economic security. And I think what we did in the early Obama administration with the setting up of the National Network for Manufacturing Initiatives, of which the Obama administration committed to 15, we now have 15, some under the last administration, is an excellent indicator of how we use the power of the Defense Department. Like I used to say, Uncle Sam is not your favorite uncle, but he is the richest one you will ever know. And I think that we should leverage as a nation that spend to achieve both national security and domestic security dominance and in the world. I look at issues like biology in other areas, AI, where I think we are behind and we could be using the department more effectively with commercial assets and commercial resources. I'm very happy to see some of the people coming into the new administration, particularly people like Jeff Zients, who's working COVID, who was very instrumental in setting up the NNMIs. While he was in the Obama White House, when I worked on it in the department, because there was a vision that we had to take a total government approach to worker training, to becoming, again, the place where people, you know, we set standards for next generation technologies and to drive economic growth that could benefit our national defense. So I think as we more completely rely on a global commercial supply chain for our defense, we have to be engaged as a department in all of those aspects. And Jerry is right. It takes a lot of coordination. And DOD just shouldn't be separated from the other agencies, whether it be USTR on rare earths or any of the other agencies. It has to be a coordinated effort. And people are so afraid of the word industrial policy. And I've never quite understood why, because we practice it every day through regulation. It should just be stated what our policy is.
And for those people who didn't know what that acronym was, it was the Manufacturing Innovation Institutes that Brett was talking about. Steve, let me get your sense, and time is running short. So think about what the next M&A strategy for the department needs to be with this new administration. But go ahead, Steve.
Let me just put a capstone, I think, on what Brett was saying, and that is to commend to your audience the page of the buildbackbetter.com, joebiden.com website that is about, what is it called? Made in all of America. I don't think it uses the word industrial policy once, but it is a hugely ambitious agenda of investment, both procurement investment that probably will ride on energy and infrastructure initiatives, but also a $300 billion commitment to invest in R&D. And what are the technologies they want to invest in? Just as Brett was saying, they're neither commercial nor defense. They're foundational technologies of the 21st century: electric vehicles, lightweight materials, 5G, artificial intelligence. Every one of those technologies and the products and capabilities that flow from them are things that Ellen Lord has talked about, as for example, the outgoing Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, and they are every bit the foundation of a great manufacturing and technology industrial base across the board of the country. So the commingling of defense industrial policy with national industrial policy is the thing to do, and is there's every indication it's exactly what the Biden administration intends.
As you're all very good friends and we know each other for a long time, I fall much more in the French side of things. The French tend to do a pretty good job of actually keeping an eye on what some of those longer range trends are to maintain its sort of strategic independence as well. Although I think they can get a little bit too closed in their ecosystem and become a little bit too aggressive in sort of driving their own industrial interests. But you know, the Brits found the total laissez-faire eventually gets you into a deep...
Oui.
Yeah, exactly. Now the shtick starts. We've got about a minute and a half left. I want to go quickly across the line on a very big question, but unfortunately, we're bumping up at the end of the show. Jerry, start us off. Right, each one of you struggled with major mergers and acquisitions. Steve, I think you're still scarred by Lockheed Northrop's failure at the end of the day. But each of you had to deal with this issue of big mergers and acquisitions and what the future policy of the nation needs to be. Jerry, start us off, Brett, and then Steve, on what you guys think. I should also say you guys are consultants all and Beltway Bandits in the finest sense of that tradition. So with that caveat, Jerry, start us off. Where does this administration need to take M&A strategy? Are we in the right place? What do they need to do differently, especially as deals like Lockheed Aerojet Rocketdyne are popping up?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think we sort of should channel Brett's, original policy back in the Obama administration, where he articulated through Ash Carter at the time is essentially and this was, followed through the Trump administration as well. It's like we want competition. We want companies to do business and mergers and acquisition to make them more effective are great. But we don't see a need for consolidation at the big prime level, at the top five or six firms, and we want to ensure in competition throughout the industrial base. So I think you'll see a lot more continuity. The only wild card is if an acolyte of Senator Warren gets into the ASD industrial policy role or something, where that would be the only place where I'd see significant change in M&A perspective, and I don't anticipate that. Oh, and one final point is the Lockheed Aerojet merger you talked about is a clear harbinger of where they're going. It's very similar to the Northrop Orbital ATK merger, which had a lot of scrutiny and ended up with a consent decree, essentially forcing Northrop to become a merchant supplier for a period of time. I would, if there's a different outcome in the Lockheed Aerojet review, I'd be surprised, number one, and a different outcome would point to a different policy priority on M&A.
And you have no dog in that fight.
I do not. I don't have a dog.
Very good. Just thought I'd ask. Brett and Steve, very quickly, give us your sense as well.
I think the policies we put in place under Obama, which is we're good until we're not, we're comfortable with where the base is, but we understand the needs of companies to consolidate at some level to get efficiencies out to lower the cost to government. And the question was always when that hits the headwinds of lowering competition, that's where we would have an issue in the department. We'll still stand. I think the wild card going forward is the commerciality of many of the players that are now an increasingly part of the defense industrial base. And so I think the department should be playing much more closely with FTC and Justice. And we didn't really have a good mechanism to do that. We tried after the Lockheed Sikorsky and getting a memo clear about the DoD's input. I'm hopeful that that will continue, because I think all of these issues are about the U.S. economy and U.S. preeminence in technology development, and less about defense unique products. And the DoD needs to have a role and a say in those decisions.
And Steve, bring us home.
I would say that it's very difficult and maybe even dangerous to try to put a broad characterization on this or any administration's outlook on merger policy, laissez-faire or otherwise. It always depends on the particulars of a particular transaction. Having said that, I do think strategic imperatives do play themselves out to some degree in the actual implementation of merger review. So for example, I think the strategic imperative of the moment is speed and innovation. By contrast, for example, one of the reasons there was a much more laissez-faire view of mergers in the 1990s when I was in the Pentagon is because the imperative was on cost, was on getting capacity and cost out of the system. And that facilitated many of the, you know, the government's fairly laissez-faire approach toward most of the mergers early in the first half of that trajectory. But right now, I think at least one of the first screens that's going to be put through every merger is the screen of how does this play for the imperatives of innovation and speed? And that may have some implications for any given merger. But other than to say that, I think it would be reckless to try to suggest that there's an overarching thesis that this administration will play out in merger review.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. And to your point, Jerry, right, at the end of the day, it's communication. And the last administration often did not communicate as well as it should have, even when there was stuff that it was doing that would have even benefited itself and benefited the public to know. So at the end of the day, good communications matter. Gentlemen, thanks so very much. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you guys back on to keep talking about industrial policy, which we all love to talk about. Thanks so much again.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.